This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCready. IWU President Richard Wilson says he's enjoyed watching students enter college, graduate, and then blossom as alumni.
I'll miss those conversations. They're at the heart of what we do.
Illinois Wesleyan's president talks with GLT's Charlie Schlenker as he prepares to say goodbye after 11 years on campus. Comedian Tig Notaro has a new HBO comedy special. She's also on Bullseye with Jesse Thorne tonight at 8. You'll hear an archived GLT interview with her prior to her 2014 appearance at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's October 19th, 2015. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In less than 2 weeks, Illinois Wesleyan University President Richard Wilson will retire and give way to his successor, Eric Jensen. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Wilson about his time in education, as well as what he'll miss about Illinois Wesleyan University.
I have to admit that I have become a bit nostalgic. In the first instance, the opportunity to interact with students on a regular basis and both as students, watch the transformation occur over the 4 years that they're at Wesleyan, and then talk with them again as alums and get to know how their lives have been impacted over the arc of their careers. And I'll miss those conversations. They're fantastic. And I think it's at the heart of what we do. You know, the faculty and staff at Illinois Wesleyan are tremendously supportive of each other. And they join in a celebration when something good happens on campus to one of their colleagues and console them when something difficult presents itself in their lives. So those are all part of being on a small college campus and feeling like you're really part of a community. So I'm going to miss that a great deal.
We all see kids grow up and transform and exult in that process. But for educators, it is something special. Can you share a couple stories of remarkable transformations that you've seen and how they affected you?
Well, one that just jumps immediately to mind, a few years ago, we had an art student who was presenting a painting as one of the exhibitions, and the painting was divided in halves. The first half was really stark colors, dark and dreary, looking almost scary in the way it was presented. And the second half was a bright, cheery, and hopeful pastels and lots of other colors. And I asked him, I said, what's the message with this painting? I don't quite follow. And he said, President Wilson, the left half is the way I was when I arrived, an angry young man. And he said, the right half is the way I'm leaving, happy and confident. And I thought, that's a good characterization of what you hope happens in terms of maybe not every student arriving angry, but at least the kind of transformation that you'd like to see when students are on campus. And the other one that comes to mind is that I was talking with an alum a few years ago. He said, you know, I know that the university really has as a goal to attract the students of the highest quality possible. But he said, you know, save room for people like me. Take a chance once in a while on someone you think can be an overachiever. He said, because the university's made all the difference in the world in my life. And he had become a very successful businessman. But he said, he started out with not the background that he thought he needed to be successful in the classroom at Wesleyan.
What will you not miss at all?
Well, you know, the schedule is unrelenting. I'm not complaining. It's part of the deal when you become a college president. But it's a 7 day a week. I often say to people, for 3 or 4 days of the week, I've got a full schedule of activity on campus, and for the next 3 days, it's usually traveling somewhere. on behalf of the university, so that it's just a continuing set of activities. And at times, it gets to be a little bit overwhelming. I also have said a lot of times people will invite me to come to a program that they're hosting, and they'll say, we only really want you to talk for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes, and we'd like for you to say something very creative, very insightful, and humorous. And so the challenge of trying to
humor
step
on
up,
tap.
Yeah. That's right. Trying to step up to that set of expectations day in and day out is a bit of a challenge, and I won't miss that too much.
Okay. How has the job of president changed over your life in education?
I suppose the obvious answer to that question is that presidents have taken on increased responsibility for identifying the resources to make the university work, and are constantly faced with economic challenges of one kind or another. There was a point in time in my career, and frankly, this pertained both to my work at the University of Illinois and to my work here at Illinois Wesleyan. Enrollment was simply not an issue because there were plenty of students, and we were following along after the baby boom, or we were following along with the various boomlets that occurred after the baby boom, and there were plenty of students. And the question was almost, how do you want to build the class in a way? And you had lots of opportunities. And so it was a very different time than we're in right now, as you know, with the absolute number of high school graduates declining across this country. And every college and university is struggling to retain market share. We're all doing all kinds of things to ensure that. So that's been the biggest change. And I think we went through a period of 20 or 30 years of relative affluence in higher education. And in this decade that's just passed, we've had two major economic crises. First, the dot-com collapse in the latter part of the 90s, early part 2000, and then, of course, the general economic collapse of 08-09 that we're still reeling from. And so college presidents these days don't get very far away from the economics of the situation.
How has education itself changed over the decades that you've been in the field?
Let me particularize my response to Illinois Wesleyan at the moment. Historically, Illinois Wesleyan has been, its core mission has been as a liberal arts institution. And along the way, we've added some professional and pre-professional programs like nursing or economics, business, music, theater, dance, education, that are grounded in that tradition. And by that, I mean students who major in those fields still have to complete the same liberal arts curriculum that other students complete who might be in the traditional liberal arts of history or chemistry, biology, or English. But what we're seeing now is tremendous pressure over the last 4 or 5 years in particular to narrow the curriculum to very specific programs that ensure students will have employment when they graduate. I personally think it's a misguided notion that's born out of the economic realities that we face as a country, because sometimes you prepare someone for a particular job and within 6 or 7 years that job goes away, and then where are you? I think we have to prepare students for leadership roles in a variety of fields so that they can make adjustments over the life of their careers.
With that emphasis on technical tracks, with the political part of the climate change deniers, with the skepticism that many in the public have toward government conducted studies about science, are we changing our view of the value of education?
I actually think that is a key question that we all face. When I talk with parents and students, frequently when they come to the Wesleyan campus, they'll take a tour and they'll say, you know, well, it's a beautiful campus. This is fantastic. They meet with faculty. They like the interactions. But at the end of the conversation, it always circles back to the value proposition. Is getting a degree from Illinois Wesleyan going to be worth it to me in 4 years? Now, it's not just Wesleyan. That question is being asked of all of higher education. And I think moving forward, we're going to have to be able to do a better job of demonstrating, not just talking about, but demonstrating the value of the degrees that students are receiving. And students are, and parents are pretty astute. I mean, we, for many years, would bring prospective students and parents to campus for honors days and open houses and things like that. And we'd always feature one of our alums who had been successful. And they look right through that. They know exactly what you're doing. And the question then that they have after it's all over, I understand how Richard Jenkins is doing as a theater major.
The exceptional person.
Tell me about the rest of the class and how your most recent class, where are they and what are they doing? And I think we owe it to ourselves, and frankly, we certainly owe it to prospectives and students and parents to be able to answer that question.
This is Sound Ideas. We're talking with the soon-to-be-retired Illinois Wesleyan University President, Richard Wilson. With the rise of technology, MOOCs, massive online courses, with computers in the classroom allowing the analysis of much larger data sets than used to be the case, with the way kids use technology at a younger age, does learning happen differently now?
I think it definitely does, and the technology that's available today is significantly different and changing. And so we have to be able to respond to that. There are those who feel that the technology is going to replace traditional forms of instruction. I don't doubt that there are some lectures that one could access that might not be possible without an online capability, particularly if you wanted to get access to some of the experts in a particular field. But what I found is that as technology is enhanced, it simply makes the more traditional classroom environment richer for everyone because instructors start doing things they haven't done in the past. And we have some faculty members at Wesleyan who are experimenting with what so-called flip classrooms. And essentially what they do is that in our day in college, you'd go to class, you'd get the homework assignment, you'd go home and work on it and bring it back to class. Now the instructors are assigning the lecture in advance, and the students go online and watch the lecture. And when they come to class, they discuss the lecture and work on the homework problems in groups. So it's just changed the nature of instruction for all of us.
And what does that do to learning? What does it do to the process?
I think it enhances the experience. You know, I was talking with a faculty member recently. She had a class last winter during one of the snowstorms, and she had a guest lecture that was supposed to arrive for the lecture. Well, the instructor couldn't come to the class, but they just brought the instructor in by video online, and the lecture went on. And I think it just creates all of these possibilities to make the instruction better. But I still believe that students and parents want to have, by and large, to the extent they can, have this direct interaction with an instructor at some point.
We are seeing various metrics come out showing high school students are or are not prepared for college and that they have deficits or not compared to their counterparts in other countries. And we've just talked some about the technological changes in the way learning happens. There are, as you first mentioned in one of your anecdotes as well, developmental progressions that happen to all kids of this age group. Given all that, are we turning out kids that are in a substantially different place educationally than they were several decades ago, or are they in fact different?
What we have is a system of higher education in this country that's not especially monolithic, and by that I mean it's not all of the same type. And students get counseled along the way as to where they ought to enter the educational system. And so one of the things that I've enjoyed about living here in Bloomington is that we have a very fine community college that many students begin their journey there. We have a small private liberal arts college and a large public university, and students can find the environment that fits for them. And I think as long as we can continue to provide these options, and we're doing just fine. Kids are coming to college with unbelievable experiences. A lot of things that used to occur on a college campus is now occurring in the high schools. And so there are still very talented kids coming to the universities out of the high schools in this state and around the country.
If you were to give advice now to your 25 or 30-year-old self, what would it be?
I was reminded of that week. We had a reception at the president's house for about 50 new international students at Illinois Wesleyan. And as I talked with these students, I was tremendously impressed with their courage. These students, by and large, came to Illinois Wesleyan sight unseen, many of them halfway around the world. I don't know if I would have had that courage, but if I could go back and do it again, I would have certainly figured out a way to bring a stronger international experience into the curriculum that I had. I went to a liberal arts college and I enjoyed my time there, but this whole global awareness thing sort of passed me by. And the opportunities that we provide for domestic students to study abroad and then the reciprocal international students to come to Wesleyan is something that if I could do it again, I would certainly try to increase that. I was very envious of one of our students who told me that she had just come back from her second study abroad experience. And I thought, wow, what I would do to have the opportunity to do that.
Richard Wilson is the outgoing president of Illinois Wesleyan University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Charlie. Appreciate it very much.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Wilson says in retirement he wants to get out of the way of the new president, Eric Jensen. He and his wife, Pat, will move to Chicago for a while to give Jensen space, but they eventually hope to move back to Bloomington Normal. Wilson says he'll travel and play golf. He hopes to keep a hand in higher education in a part-time way, perhaps advising new college presidents quietly or helping institutions get ready for fundraising campaigns. Hear more from Wilson about the costs of higher education at our website, WGLT.org. Ahead during Sound Ideas, it's an edition of Jazz Next. You'll hear from Ramsey Lewis, who had a top Billboard hit 50 years ago this week, with this song. Jazz Next is on the way during Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Comedian Tig Notaro is Jesse Thorne's guest during Bullseye tonight at 8 on GLT. Notaro is the subject of a documentary now streaming on Netflix called Tig. It's about her life, specifically her health struggles, and the very open way she handled them during her stand-up routine. Here's a clip from the Netflix trailer for Tig.
The doctor said my insides were inflamed beyond recognition. A week later, my mother died.
And then I found a lump.
After everything that had happened, I have cancer.
As soon as I was diagnosed, everything came over me as funny.
I love stand-up so much, I wanted to do it one more time.
Good evening, hello. I have cancer, how are you?
I was sitting there watching, and I texted, Tig is doing something historic.
Tig Notaro's recent national tour, Boyish Girl Interrupted, is now a comedy special airing on HBO. In early 2014, I spoke with Tig Notaro ahead of her show in Bloomington. We started out talking about Taylor Dayne. The 80s pop star is the subject of one of her funniest bits called A Deeply Personal Story About Taylor Dayne. So I asked her, how is Taylor Dayne?
I have not talked to her recently. I think that it'd be more often. But we do have each other's numbers, and we'll text every now and then.
It was quite often, and I just wonder if the Taylor Dayne bit actually did grow organically out of you simply running into her over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, the whole story is true, and I organically ran into her and organically built the story, and there's really not any exaggeration to it. There's a, you know, there's what if moments, and I maybe not even what if. I think it's just a factual, ridiculous story that's authentically built.
I actually feel confident that I'm the reason that Taylor Dayne ended up putting out another record. Because, you know, she called her manager. I was like, my fans miss me. They love me. I mean, sure, they're a bunch of he-she-looking robots. Excuse me. I'm sorry to bother you. But I just have to tell you. I love your voice. Excuse me. I'm sorry to bother you. But I just have to tell you. Excuse me. People are always like, there is no way that story's true. It's like, why would I make up a 14-minute story about a pop singer that nobody's really heard of? And just as a side note, I left out other times that I ran into Taylor Dayne. Anyway, my name's Tig. Thanks so much.
Well into the Taylor Dayne stand-up, you asked the audience something like, you'll never guess who I ran into. And the audience and the audience assumes it's a rhetorical question. They know the answer is Taylor Dayne. But you wait for someone in the audience to actually shout out Taylor Dayne. How long will you wait for an answer?
I will wait forever. And when I was in Australia, the audience was so polite that when I said, you'll never believe who I ran into, or guess who I ran into, they just sat there quietly. And I said, no, guess. I'm asking you to guess. And nobody said anything. And so I just sat there and I said, I'm not going to move on until somebody guesses. And so I just sat on stage and stared back at them. And I remember the sound person coming over once the show ended, just panicked, out of breath. Like, oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. I thought I was going to die during the Taylor Dayne when nobody was. I didn't. Yeah, that went on for like 5 minutes. And I was like, yeah, I thought it just built up the tension of the show.
And it was so great. And it's that tension I want to explore for a moment. You can hear the laughter, even with an American audience, when they answer fairly quickly. You can hear the laughter sort of shift a little bit. It gets this nervous tinge to it.
Then like 9 months passed. And I happened to be out to eat with that same friend of mine, Pam. There was a party of 10 seated right behind us. You guys are not going to believe who was sitting there. Any guesses? Just think about the story I've been telling.
Taylor Dayne. Taylor Dayne.
Yeah, it was Taylor Dayne. That's exactly who it was.
What is it about making the audience squirm that you like?
My Pam was like, oh my God.
I think just the release. It just, when the audience is uncomfortable or squirming, when all of that is released, it's, the laugh is so gigantic. And everything that follows after that is heightened. And I feel like the jokes that follow, just all of it, it just is, I really enjoy it.
I enjoy it too. And I think it's a great technique to sort of disarm the audience as well.
Uh-huh.
You told the Taylor Dayne story on the live This American Life program, and we had a Facebook question from our audience who someone wanted to know, what has This American Life and Taylor Dayne done for your career, and how have you helped Taylor Dayne?
You know, I think I have opened her to a whole new world. I mean, I don't think the NPR world and the Taylor Dayne world were very intertwined.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. And I was in a bar in New York at like 4 a.m. with this other comedian just talking, and all of a sudden, Taylor Dane's Tell It to My Heart came on the jukebox, and I turned around like, oh my gosh, how crazy. And there was some hipster kid laughing, and he was like, I played that for you. And I was like, oh my gosh. You know, of course, this guy probably didn't even know who Taylor Dane was before that. So I guess I've sent some unlikely fans her way.
So
whether it's genuine or ironic.
So these two audiences that don't meet, the Taylor Dane audience and the public radio audience, This American Life has opened the door perhaps to a new audience for you, though, the public radio audience.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. It's just kind of crisscrossed a bit. It's nice.
How do interviews like this, the internet, TV appearances, work in favor or against a live performance? Are the jokes funny for people a second time around?
I think so. I wouldn't think people should expect every, like, Taylor Dane or the impressions at the show. I haven't done Taylor Dane since, you know, probably a year and a half, since I did it on This American Life. I think I've done it since that day.
It lives forever on the internet, though.
Yeah. But so I don't know if people should be showing up. And maybe, you know, I'll pepper in some old jokes, maybe one or two in an hour show. But in general, I have an all new hour of material. And it is funny, you know, when people see a joke pop up on the internet and it'll be three or four different places on the internet, and then people are like angry, put up new stuff. Why don't you write some new material? And it's like, I am, but I'm not the one putting the stuff up on the internet. You know, they think that I'm the one posting that and that it's my one joke that I do. You know what I mean? I have all new material.
Conan O'Brien seems to be a fan. You're on the show regularly. You've appeared on Conan's After Hours stand-up series online. It used to be that appearing on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson was the big break, and especially getting invited to sit down with Johnny after the stand-up. That was a huge recognition. Is there anything out there like that today? Is it Conan, Letterman, Kimmel? Do you have to sort of do them all now?
I think it's This American Life, to be honest. That was a huge bump for me in my career. They have millions of listeners and so devoted, that fan base. And it's not just some comedian that Ira, you know, has to just book every week. You know, it's something special that he's excited about or a story he's excited about. And then I think it is, for me, it's helpful to be on Conan and hopefully do something funny or special on there that will stick with people. But I don't really know what the big, I don't think there is a big talk show break these days.
It's interesting you said This American Life, because I think Ira is really plugged into his audience and the public radio audience, and he's not going to bring somebody to that audience that he doesn't think they're going to like. I think there's this instant sort of recognition that this is something that Tig Notaro, somebody, you know, a public radio listener should pay attention to, and there's sort of maybe an instant loyalty, do you think?
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying that's why it's so powerful to be on This American Life, is because it's not just, yeah, let's have that person on. They're really behind who they've invited on their show and the story they're telling, and the fan base is just so devoted. And I think when you get into that loop, it's really helpful. You know, it's made David Sedaris and Mike Birbiglia, their careers explode.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. On the phone is Tig Notaro. Tig, can we talk a little bit about your health?
Sure.
First of all, how are you doing? Are you getting tired of that question?
I think it's nice, and I like to get it out there that I'm doing well, because there is a lot of information that I was not doing well. So no, I don't mind saying that I'm doing really well, and I feel great, and I'm in remission, and I'm very focused on keeping my health in tip-top shape.
You dropped the cancer bomb at the now sort of legendary set at Largo. How did you decide to roll that out on stage?
I had this one show booked, and I had just been diagnosed, and my mother had just died, and all this stuff had happened in a short period of time, and I think because my life had fallen apart so quickly, and when I was diagnosed with invasive bilateral cancer, I just thought, well, I guess I'm going to die, because nothing else in my life had been positive, and I just wanted to go on stage one last time before I started treatment or before I died or whatever was happening. I just didn't know, and I love stand-up so much that, yeah, I wanted to perform another time, and I didn't feel like it would be authentic to talk about Taylor Dayne or anything other than what was going on in my life. So I felt like it was my only choice, really.
Hello. Good evening. Hello. I have cancer. How are you? Hi, how are you? Is everybody having a good time? I have cancer. How are you? It's a good time. Diagnosed with cancer. Feels good. Just diagnosed with cancer. God. Oh my God. It's weird because with humor, the equation is tragedy plus time equals comedy. I am just at tragedy right now.
It's a really strange line you're walking there.
Yeah, tell me about it.
I mean, probably even more strange for you than for the audience.
Right. It was something that I did not imagine would go over as well as it did. And, you know, as you heard, it's not like it was start to finish the most hilarious show of all time. But it was just a moment in time and a very unusual show. And the audience was just fantastic. They were just fantastic because they didn't know. I didn't know how to navigate through the show. They didn't know how to navigate through the show. I was at times saying things that weren't funny. They were at times not laughing, then laughing. And it just, we made it through it together, you know?
Yeah, it almost seems like maybe it wouldn't have worked with a different audience.
I always tell people that those were the exact perfect people that were at the show that night. They completely helped me through that.
That's comedian Tig Notaro. Our interview was recorded shortly before her performance in Bloomington early last year. Her HBO comedy special is called Boyish Girl Interrupted. The documentary Tig is currently streaming on Netflix. You can hear more from Tig Notaro during Bullseye with Jesse Thorne tonight at 8 on GLT. Taylor Dayne on Sound Ideas. Tomorrow, Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in the studio to talk about downtown redevelopment proposals. The council hears from two developers tonight. Listen tomorrow during Morning Edition for more about the proposal. And then during Sound Ideas at 11 a.m., ask the mayor your questions about downtown Bloomington redevelopment. That's tomorrow at 11 a.m. during Sound Ideas on GLT. In 30 seconds, subtlety doesn't work.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith was there. And
this is your not-so-subtle hint about the 2015 Radio Faces event.
NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
But as NPR's Tamara Keith reports, it might...
NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
GLT's Radio Faces, November 13th, with two ticket levels, cocktails, dinner, and conversation with
Tamara Keith, NPR News, Manchester, New Hampshire.
Port-au-Prince.
Washington.
Des Moines.
Traveling with the President.
Find more information and tickets for GLT's Radio Faces at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Heartland Community College. Fall is harvest time, and you can enjoy the bounty of learning through Heartland's Community Education Program. Class and registration details in your community education booklet or at heartland.edu/communityed. This is GLT.
And it's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy, an Illinois State University professor of dance and music, went on a journey of discovery in the slave dungeons of Africa and discovered a story she's eager to share. Laura Kennedy has more on the GLT Datebook.
Coming up Saturday, October 24th at 8 p.m. and Sunday the 25th at 4 p.m. in Kemp Recital Hall, it's Walking with My Ancestors, the creation of Illinois State University professor Ama Ofori-Wa Adeyanum. This is a theatrical event with drumming, singing, dancing, and acting that explores the experiences of enslaved Africans in slave-holding dungeons. Adeyanum was inspired to create this unique theatrical event when she took a trip to Senegal and Ghana.
I took several tours in the dungeons. I also sat for many hours in the dungeons trying to reflect and to imagine what those ancestors experienced and how they survived that tragic journey before getting onto the boat to the Americas.
That sounds like a very powerful experience.
It was a very powerful experience. I became transformed. I sat in there and I imagined being starved, being raped, the oceans moaning and thinking about bones lying alone on the ocean floors. This is such an important tradition and such an important culture, history that as a people we don't talk much about. So while I sat in the dungeons and I was thinking and imagining, I started writing poetry about the experience and all these imaginations. And I put all those things down. I was also inspired to choreograph dances in response to all the feelings that I was going through. And then I wrote music.
What are you hoping to achieve with this big theatrical work?
Many people are unaware that before their shipment to the Americas, captured Africans were kept in dungeons. And I think people really need to know that because it really helps us to expand our thinking of slavery. These dungeons is where those Africans became slaves. They went in as Africans, came out as slaves. So these dungeons for me are the tombs in which they were buried, but also reborn as slaves.
The act of creating this and bringing it to life on stage, did you find any answers or even any peace to the difficult questions of slavery?
No, I'm still searching. I'm still searching.
So you will have performers on stage with dancing and drumming and so forth, but do you plan to get the audience involved in the experience?
Definitely. You know, my performances are, the audience have to be a part of the performance, right? We are all on this journey, and the audience have to be a part of it to really experience the power of this piece. So yes, they'll be clapping and singing and moving and sharing stories and just words of wisdom. This show is very powerful, and I would like to ask the audience to listen to this story and not to take it personal. Because people come in there and they think they are being attacked. That is not the point of the story. This play performance is about a people's experience in dungeons, how they survived, how they were able to move on. And I think it's a story that, even though it's African, I think it's a story that we can all connect with, right? We're talking about longing, trauma, dislocation, memory, loss. All these are human things that we all go through. I'd like to ask the audience to basically try to connect to that story and find a place where their own voices can be heard.
You've got several drums here mm-hmm. in your office. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could demonstrate mm-hmm. maybe something that we'll be hearing okay. at the performance. What do we call this drum?
Well, this mm-hmm. is called the Kpanlogo drum. Kpanlogo drum is used to accompany a dance called Kpanlogo in Ghana. It's a very resonating sound. So I'm going to play it.
Edina benywa eh, anana benywa insupi otakurumo wa dani mbusumpo.
That's ISU professor Ama Oforiwa Adeyanu. Walking with My Ancestors is Saturday the 24th at 8 p.m. and Sunday the 25th at 4 p.m. in ISU's Kemp Recital Hall. Admission is free. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The stage show Walking with My Ancestors is part of the cultural offerings on the campus of Illinois State University during Homecoming Week. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It was 50 years ago this month that Chicago's Ramsey Lewis accomplished the unlikely. He hit the number 5 position on the Billboard pop charts with a jazz instrumental version of a Dobie Gray pop song. In this edition of GLT Jazz Next, Lewis details the importance of jazz and shares how hitting the upper echelons of the pop chart transformed his career.
Hi, I'm Ramsey Lewis. I love music. Well, I love piano in particular. In fact, that's my instrument. I live in Chicago, which is a big musical town, all kinds of music that whatever you love, you can hear it here in Chicago. I'm just having fun with life, and I'm sure you're having fun now because you're listening to GLP Jazz. Jazz, whether we need it or not, it is America's only original art form that we contribute to the stage of world culture. If you look at all the countries from around the world and say, oh, well, this came from them. Oh, ballet. Oh, well, what came from America? You can say country western, maybe. I think the only original, if you want to say, art form is jazz. Also, it's one of the few musics from around the world where the accent is on theme and development and improvisation on the spur of the moment. So it's a very important music. Young people need to know about the music, and there was a time when that happened too. I went to a public high school here in Chicago. It was multicultural. We had a jazz band. In those days, the instruments were provided by the school. The chemistry lab was all supplied by the school. I mean, we had a great school. A lot of kids went on and did other things with their lives, and some kids were exposed to jazz. And so if the word need is ever used by me, I think that culturally, young American students should at least be exposed to something that is original and originally from our country. L.D. Young, Red Holt, and I were in Washington, D.C. We were going to record that Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We had all our songs together. We got in a few days early because we were going to record, and we needed one more song. The In Crowd was our 17th album. Our last two or three albums before that, we got in the habit of doing a song that we call like a dessert song, a fun song, if you will, to complete a meal, if you will. And we didn't have one of those for this album. We needed something just kind of light and gay and fun. And we were sitting there in a coffee shop, which had a jukebox in those days. Coffee had shops, no big deal for them to have a jukebox. The waitress came over, I think her name was Nettie Gray, because we stopped there a lot of times. And what are you guys doing? Well, we're trying to find a song. What kind of song? Well, you know, something catchy or fun or danceable or, you know, easy going. Have you ever heard the In Crowd? Eldie and Red had heard the In Crowd. I had not. She said, it was on a jukebox. It's really big, Ramsey. You should have heard it by now. She played it. I said, oh, right, that song.
I'm in with the In Crowd. I go where the In Crowd goes. I'm in with the In Crowd. And I know what the In Crowd knows. Any time of the year, don't be here. Dress in mind, make it time. We feel up and down the street. We get respect from the people we meet. They may wait day or night.
I listened to it. Yeah, we can do that. You know, it's simple, it's easy, you know. So we bought the record. We had a little phonograph we carried on the road with us and bought it on a 45. And we played it a few times at the hotel. We learned it, went down, and we rehearsed it a couple of times. We didn't expect a lot from it. In our minds, it was something that was just going to fill out the album. We had what we call the appetizers, the entree, the meat of the album, and then we wanted this fun song, and we thought this would be great.
We make every minute count, yeah. Our share is always the biggest amount. Other guys imitate us, but the original's still the greatest.
That Thursday night, we were finishing our set, so we said, let's finish with that new song. You know, it's interesting. The Bohemian Caverns in Washington, D.C. was the big jazz bastion of where when Thelonious Monk came to town, when Coltrane came to town, and Johnny Griffin. I mean, these hard boppers. This was where they played. So it's the kind of crowd we had. Not all, because some of those people obviously didn't take to our music, but some did, and we had our own fans. But anyway, the place went bananas. They started clapping their hands and patting their feet. A couple of people were over at the bar dancing. And we just looked at each other like, what's going on? So after the set, Esmond Edwards was our producer. He says, God, you guys really picked a good one there. We were like, well, I guess we did. So we Thursday night, two sets. Friday night, two sets. Saturday night, three sets. Each set, we ended with that song, and every time we ended it, the place would go crazy. Even at that, we figured, oh, you know, okay, so we'll put it on the album. I think we recorded it in April or March or something, and the album came out in June. It was early fall, September, October. We got a call from the Chess people saying, I think you guys got a hit. I said, What do you mean a hit? What do you say? Well, that song you recorded called The In Crowd. I said, yeah. People are going in the record stores asking for it. No, my life changed permanently. Up until that point, I mean, you know, we had to call ahead to see, well, how much are the hotel rooms? Okay, we'll stay there. And we had various places in each town that we knew we could get dinner for a certain price. And when that happened, I'll never forget, in Washington, D.C., there was this hotel. Every time we'd pass it, somebody would say, you know, Ella Fitzgerald stays there. And we couldn't afford to stay there. Well, the first time I stayed there, it was because of the In Crowd. And I said, this is really great. I can get used to this. And the other thing that was obvious, we'd go into a restaurant we hadn't been in before, and before we looked at what was on the menu, we'd look at the price side. Let's see where the prices are. So it was great to go into places that we'd always wanted to visit and have fun without figuring, oops, is that in the budget? Of course, that could get out of hand, too, so we had to be careful. But that's the first thing I noticed, besides the crowds. We had begun growing pretty good crowds anyway, but when the In Crowd really hit, as you know, it was like a pop record, so we started drawing huge crowds, and that was fun. Hi, I'm Ramsey Lewis. You're listening to GLP Jazz.
Listening to The In Crowd. 50 years ago this month, Ramsey Lewis hit the number 5 position on the Billboard pop music charts with this Dobie Gray cover. You can hear the music of Ramsey Lewis as well as other jazz legends and up-and-comers by clicking Jazz Radio at the top of WGLT.org. Find the Jazz Next podcast at our website along with everything you hear on Sound Ideas, including this episode with help from Willis Kern, Charlie Schlenker, Laura Kennedy, and John Norton. All of us want to know what you think of the interviews and stories you hear during Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Email us. The address is news@WGLT.org. Or tweet. Use the hashtag SoundIdeas. I'm Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is WGLT Normal News and Ideas.